Hey everybody, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Yay, I give a shit about you. I don't know what I can do. But you can write me and I'll help you. I'm here for you. So anyway, besides Brill Cream, a little dab will do you as our sponsor today. I also want to make sure that you know about our fundraiser and season one wrap party, which I am very, very, very excited about. I've invited all the guests, previous guests who've been on my show, to come. So it could be quite a crowd, quite a crazy. There could be a big bar fight, I think. I'm not sure. I hope they have bouncers. They usually do. Okay, we'll be fine. Anyway, so I'm going to read. I'm actually going to just read what I've been. I'm going to do what I was asked to do here by note. It says, host, please read on mic. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like what you're hearing, please consider supporting us. This is not going well. Come to the fucking rap party. It's season one party and fundraiser, and it's Friday, October 23rd at 8 p.m. at, honest to God, my favorite bar. I think I was there every night this week so far. Seriously. Pine Box Rock Shop, 12 Grattan Street in Bushwick, right next to the Morgan L stop. And, yeah, you can usually find me passed out in front of there most mornings around 1 a.m. The event will be emceed by Gabriel St. Evanson, the host of Radio Free Brooklyn's Electric Year. And it also features performances by Doll Parts, which is Brooklyn's premier Dolly Parton tribute band. Woo! Singer-songwriter Mississippi Cotton. Burlesque by Miss Legs Malone. She's really hot. I've met her. DJ sets by Radio Free Brooklyn hosts, and a special screening of Lofty Dreams, a new Bushwick-based web series. Awesome. There'll be also prizes, raffles, and swag giveaways, and the first 25 people to arrive will receive a special free gift. I just keep thinking blowjob for me. I can't help it. That's a joke. I'm kidding. Admission is pay what you wish, but any amount will help us keep Radio Free Brooklyn, on the air. This costs money to operate this shit. Once again, that's Friday, October 23rd at 8 p.m. at Pine Box Rock Shop in Brooklyn. See you there. So anyway, I want to tell you about my guest that I have today. This is actually one of my closest friends, I think. Is that okay if I say that? This is David Kramer.
You could say that. That's okay.
Yeah, we've known each other. That's okay. you're supposed to say, oh, yes.
Yeah, of course.
There
we go way back.
We do go way back. And actually, I met David's work before I met him, which was, I don't know, in the 90s somewhere. And I was like, wow, this is fucking incredible work. It was just really simply writing, literally pen and ink, ballpoint pen writing on yellow lined paper, and I was totally blown away by it. And over the years, we've gotten to know, we've gotten to hang out and really become friends. We've, actually maybe been in a show or two together and done a little. I hosted a wine, WHIW, anyway. Fuck it. Oh, I've also
The wine tasting.
Remember the wine tasting?
Oh, yes, sure.
And then I also had gotten pretty close to David's kid, somewhat close to David's kid. He was on here a few weeks ago.
He was your intern.
My intern for the summer. And, I'm involved still, with the whole, Susan, the whole family.
I'm still, angry at you because Martin was on the show before I was, so.
Yeah, that's just bullshit. He's trying to get you on his side. I see right through that, David Kramer. So anyway, David is a wildly talented and extremely successful, well-respected artist. He's just in from Europe, and he'll only be – so David, tell us like really – okay, David's career is stellar. What's your website? You have a website or something?
No, I don't have a website. Okay. People who are – as successful as me don't need to have a website.
I figured. You don't have to go to that much trouble.
No.
You're just using people like me to get the word out. Anyway, look it up. David Kramer, Kramer with a K. Yeah. But, David, tell us, like, what you've been doing the last couple of weeks. So you were in Europe and Nebraska.
That's right. I have a show up right now in Munich. It's called Kramerica, and it's a show of paintings and installations and a video. And then I got to go to Lincoln, Nebraska, which is where I have a show up also right now. And then I have a show in Bushwick at the moment at Parlor.
Parlor.
So I mentioned that because we're sitting in Brooklyn. That's a group show.
No, it's a good
terrific
group show. It's a great
gallery. And, and I'm leaving for Paris on Sunday just to go to a party, really. That's how I roll.
Can you believe this? No, David's gallerist is having the 10th anniversary, and so David actually kind of has to go.
No, that's a...
God there's some socializing and free booze around this whole art thing, because otherwise, what the fuck? Who would be doing this?
Yeah. No, it's going to be fun. That gallery, Laurent Godin, I've been working with Laurent for about six of his 10 years, and... He told me he was having a 10-year reunion, and...
He sold hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of your paintings. It's true, isn't it, David? Not at one time,
if you stretch it out.
No. He has sold, like, hundreds, literally... David's paintings go for... I don't know, mid five figures, low five. Lot of money. A lot of money. More than yours. More than that fucking drawing in your refrigerator. Anyway,
no, but I've done. We've done pretty well.
David's in that. You know, he makes money. I mean, he makes.
I'm rolling. He's had money right now. Don't tell my landlord because I haven't paid the rent on my studio yet this month.
So I thought this might be a really fun time to a fun conversation, because I thought, like, David and I, when we get together, we talk about how anxious we are about our careers, and that we're worried about our careers and we're worried about our work and whether our work is progressing.
But, and that's what our work is really about, right? I mean, I think you as well.
So,
your paintings are
very, they're
very
all
much
about my insecurities.
Your insecurities and mine are all about my every time I shoot myself in the foot. That's
the way I feel too. Exactly. Like, I was at home literally screaming out loud this morning. I was so nervous about, like, projects I'm working on, and But the thing is, when I look at David from the outside, I'm like, he's like, fuck. Who wouldn't want that career? He's like literally flying all over the world, has like rich people buying his work. The work is great. That's the most important part.
That's the only part. I'm supposed to say that.
No, it's great work. All of it. And, you know, like, it's like he's got like a stellar career.
Uh-huh.
But then when you sit down, I think that's partly why I like you so much, David.
Because when you sit down,
I love you so much.
Because when I sit down and talk about it, I complain heavily.
I'm like, oh, it doesn't. Oh, he does. He like I identify with you.
Yeah.
You make me feel better because I think you're doing so great, and it's like you're just as miserable as I am. So.
Well, it is a lot of. It's all smoke and mirrors, actually. The whole career is. Well, you know, I mean, it's been very interesting. I did have a great show in Munich right now, and it was really amazing to go to Munich to have a show and be, I've never shown in Germany, and to have the response was pretty incredible. But, you know, at the same time, yeah, I didn't, they have, sales are a whole other ball of wax, and so, you know, it's like you sit there and you say, "Wow, I got all this positive sales." Are
you
like
got
sort
a lot
of
press, right?
I got a lot of press closing, you know, but it's been a
show's
tough
still
go.
Up. They're having another big party there.
They're going to have a big party, and I'm going to be in Paris instead of Munich.
I'm
but,
so sorry.
Yeah, well, if you had to choose, you would definitely choose Paris, I think, over Munich. But that's
a good choice to have. So, David, like you. Also have a wonderful, wonderful brilliant, attractive, supportive wife.
Yes, I do.
And fantastic mother.
And fantastic mother.
And an amazing...
Who is also like she's doing God's work over in Brooklyn right now. She's the she's a public defender. And so, you know, fortunately for us, she, you know, has this job, but her job is the exact opposite of my glamorous life. I get to go to a party in Paris, and she'll be at Rikers Island interviewing one of her clients next week. So,
yeah, I mean, so, and
so it causes a lot of resentment sometimes at home.
It's got to. But the thing is that you have. What I'm trying to say is that you have financial responsibility, real financial responsibility, because you've actually proven that you can make a good amount of money, like you said.
Well,
you
when it comes down to it, I mean, literally, you know, I have this old-fashioned, very 1950s sexist view that I'm supposed to make more money than my wife.
And, oh, you do? I didn't know that.
Which I always get to flaunt when I am, and when I'm not, then I have to, kowtow around.
So it's actually, see, this is so interesting. I always thought that it was just like, you know, you wanted to make money and you wanted money, but now I'm hearing that maybe it's a little bit of your male masculine pride.
Sure. No, I mean.
Wow, that's so cool. I wish more men had masculine pride like that. Half of them that come in here would be happy to, or half the men I meet out in Bushwick would be happy to be having some woman pay the bills.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really, that wasn't really the deal for, you know, that we both got into. I was, I do, you know, and I like, you know, right now, it's been a really tough year financially in a lot of ways, but I get by, you know, with some things selling, and also I work at times doing carpentry jobs and things like that, because I just you have to do things to being an artist is a very strange profession when it comes to money, and you really have to not think about money when you're doing your work. That's really the last thing you need to think about. And I think it's always like to me just I get to feel very proud of myself when I'm making a lot of it.
It feels good.
Yeah, it's been a while, but
oh, look how embarrassed he is. He's turning red. Look at this.
Yeah.
So, David, are you embarrassed?
Yeah, yeah. I'm bright red right now.
Look at this. This is so funny.
I'm very fidgety all of a sudden.
Well, I think you're doing well. You're doing well.
No, but I'm really like the funny thing is that the content of the work that I make is always this work about, you know, desire for like this good life, this, and the subject matter is always about that, you know, particularly with the imagery that I draw from or call from, it's always about this good life kind of thing. And then I usually have text involved, and the text is always sort of about how I've stumbled on my way towards the brass ring, and that is really, you know, the backstory of myself is really what these pieces are all about, is that, you know, and hey, I'm aspiring for what I expected it would be like to
be an artist
or just a dude living in New York as a kid. You know, when I looked at magazines, this is what it was all supposed to look like. It doesn't look like that.
Right, because a lot of the imagery is sort of adapted from a reminiscent of like kind of like car and cigarette advertising from the 70s.
I mean, as a kid in the 70s, I was born in Manhattan. We moved to the Westchester. I moved to New Rochelle. I sat in the suburbs. My parents got all these magazines sent to us, and I would look at them all the time, and I would just look at the pictures of the advertisements for whiskey ads and stuff and think, man, when you get to be an adult, it's a lot more fun than the suburbs. I mean, this is... So, you know, it's like you move to the city. I moved to the city right as soon as I could, and when you move to the city, you expected that your life would involve, like, this swanky apartment with a cool stereo and shag carpeting.
And
and, like, you know, and the phone would ring and you'd have parties and all that. But, you know, really it's like So it never really looked like that.
But I think that's only because you didn't buy the exact right brand of cigarettes and alcohol.
That's right. Exactly.
Because that's the promises they make you.
That's exactly right.
And it actually does work on a child.
Well, as a child, that was what completely worked on me, and I haven't grown up very much since then. So,
did you like that idea of like just being on your own and being like a dude?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a lot of fun, I didn't come from I came from a family that was stable. My father
was a lawyer.
My dad was a lawyer, and my mother was had a job. She worked. She was a business, and you know, worked for a corporation as. So we had some money we were a strongly middle class family, but there wasn't like, it wasn't like I ever came to New York and had someone pay my rent for me, you know.
It was
always very much a struggle to make a living, to learn how to make a living, and then, you know, eventually I was able to make a living as an artist. And but I do really love, I do have this crazy work ethic. I like working, so now I sometimes, I mean, I. Even if I like the idea of going to do carpentry jobs and construction, or I worked as a butcher for a while. It was just interesting to work because it's also much more straightforward to get paid for the work you do and to do work for a week and see that you've done something over a week. And so in the studio, it's a much more kind of endless drifting in a way. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. That didn't really answer your question about whether I like being.
Fuck that. No, but you know what? It sounds like a lot of what you were interested in is it sounds like maybe you were bored of the suburbs and you were interested
a
lot more. That's what you were looking for.
No.
Excitement.
I mean, as a kid, my parents both got up at. I mean, my father left for work before I woke up and he came home soon, you know, right before I went to sleep, basically. And my mother would leave and come and I would see her in the early evenings. And as soon as I was old enough, I was like, why did we move out of New York? Why, I hate living in Westchester. Like, why don't we live in Manhattan? Like, that's where you go every day. Why do you get to go there and I'm stuck here? So,
now look at and your wife is stuck in Manhattan. And,
yeah.
No. But so let's, like, what, how did you, but when you married, when you got married, you guys have been married a long time. How long?
I've been married for about 21 years right now.
Right. So let's say that's sort of the beginning of your adult life journey or something
you
like
could that. Say that.
The journey you're on, right? The phase of the leg of the journey you're on now,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So when you started that journey, you were, that sounds so corny.
It does.
Journey, David. I'm so fucking
It's all
corny.
A journey.
It's okay. No, but anyway, you, okay, so when you got married, were you like, were you working in construction? What was the deal then?
Well, it's very funny with Susan. Well, here's the story. When I was a young artist back, I fell down an elevator shaft and broke all my ribs, and it was like this horrible time for me, but. After that ended, there was a lawsuit. I got a couple $1,000s for this mm-hmm. lawsuit, so I had a little extra money. So I was for the first time in my life, really. So I went on this trip with these friends of mine. We went to Brazil. We hung around for like 3 weeks, and then I came back. And like the day I came back, I met Susan somewhere, and at an opening, and we just really I hit it off with her in a way that was just so much fun. And then. I had some money, so I bought it. She lived in Hawaii at the time, so I bought a ticket to go visit her in Hawaii, and we spent like a week and a half together. And then I went home, and then I sent her, you know, this is well before internet, so we were just writing letters to each other, and I sent her a letter in the mail asking her if she wanted to get married. And she
wow.
called me and said yes, and so we met. And then I flew to Las Vegas, and then I was done with money after that. I had spent everything, but we got married in Las Vegas. And we had known each other for maybe 3 months, but we had spent maybe 6 weeks together before we got married.
That's so crazy, right?
So it was totally crazy.
You know how crazy that is.
So when we got, so she thought that I was like this jet-setting kind of guy who was going everywhere, and then I ran out of money right after that.
Well, you reeled her in.
I reeled her in, exactly.
No, did you guys, so you guys really, I mean, you're kidding, but you guys hadn't really worked out finances or talked about any of that practical
We still
shit?
Haven't had that conversation, so thank God.
So, but okay, so let's just say this. It you work it out as it goes.
Yeah.
You haven't like made rules.
No, I mean, neither of us. That's an amazing thing about my relationship with her is that we've rolled with everything from the time we met until having a kid. We were married for 7 years, and then we had a kid, and Martin's my son, and he's now 15. And, yeah, we've basically just everything that comes up we've been able to take care of. And, you know, yeah, at times by the time he goes to college, I'm going to have to figure out a way to make a lot more money.
Shit. No, but you know, so that's probably, but see, you know, you'll work it out.
Yeah.
See, there's probably good negotiating
skills
there, right?
Yeah, no, things are good. I mean, that is like the thing that I have found.
You said that things are good.
Yeah, no, I know. It's
did
the
you hear
curse.
That?
That's the curse.
Kramer
I shouldn't have said
that.
I never should admit that.
No.
Yeah, but. Yeah, but, the funny thing is that, when I was really in a period of my life where I was just doing, like, carpentry jobs to make a living, and I was not making any money as an artist at whatsoever, I used to find that if I would just say out loud, man, I could really use a job right now, someone would call and something would fall out of the sky. And that, I mean, that's sort of, that does kind of draw a picture of what, of how I roll now and how things roll. I mean, it's difficult at times, but things work out, and you know, it's been
things do work out. And yeah. Susan also, I mean, just so like people don't think that you know you married somebody who was like gung ho lawyer. I mean, Susan is a performer herself, right?
Yeah. When we first 7 years before my son was born, we were both actively performing all the time in theater groups and, these black box sort of variety mm-hmm. shows. She's very talented. She's really great. And, you know, that's why that helps her a lot as a lawyer. As a defense lawyer being in front of people. She's very at ease with that, much more at ease than I am. I mean,
probably.
I'm sitting here fidgeting and turning red.
Yeah, I keep trying to figure out if you're comfortable or not. This is the thing about Kramer. Like, Kramer and I have done a couple of things together, and it always he's actually, David, as I've told you, I mean, he's a much better actor than I am. Like,
I don't know about
he's
that.
Great. Like,
you're a
you've
natural.
Been in movies and stuff like that. And when you can do a script, you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like kind of good off the cuff. Give me a script. Nah, I don't know. But, you know, or a character that, you know, whatever. David's like a real actor. Frankly.
Well, I don't know. But I'm really like.
But he gets so freaked out before he gets on stage. So
to pull the curtain back, you know, for anyone listening,
yeah,
asked me to do this an hour ago, and thank God you waited till now, because otherwise I would have been up all night, like,
no, really?
I'm going to be on the radio.
No, really?
Yeah, totally. I'm like,
really? I have a hard time believing that, because I look at you and I think like, oh, you know, you always seem very like comfortable, and
yeah,
so,
that's
but
what
then
my,
I
my
but then I have seen you in that mode like right before going on stage, and I'm like, who is this person? Why like
my friends in high school used to say like, you're the most laid back uptight guy I know. that's sort of how it is, and that actually is has always worked very well for me as a you know, when any kind of real, like, serious sort of negotiations, I'm so laid back that the other person just thinks that, like, if someone tells me really good news or really bad news, I just don't respond. And so it's sort of like a very cool negotiating tool.
So is that because you're feeling, what do you feel when you don't respond?
Well, my mind is working, but I just have a very,
let them know.
It's not that I don't want to let them know. I'm just very, I guess I just have a thick skin. I don't know. It just takes a lot to, you know.
For you to emote?
For me to emote, yeah.
So it sounds like you and Susan are good at, like, you know.
She tells me really good news or really bad news, and I don't respond.
Yeah. And then she's a good actress, so yeah. No. Does she get frustrated with you, or I bet you respond more around her?
Yeah. No. We have a great. I'm sure she gets frustrated with me all the time. You know. I just never pay attention.
So. I'm sure she does too. But it rolls off of you, right?
It's not that I'm really so cool under pressure. I'm just so distracted that I don't really pay attention to what's happening. That's it's my ADD is kicking in. So.
So what was I going to say? There was something I was going to say, which was. I've had a thought. I really didn't. I lost it. And it's really great to do that on the air because when you do that, you really just fill up air and you're boring.
Say a lot. I think that helps.
Oh, yeah. So what this is what I was going to say. So like there must have been a transition from when you were working as a, whatever, you do carpentry, construction,
house painting.
So was there must have been a transition between that and doing selling your work, making money at
Ironically, it was the opposite. At a certain point, I just said, out loud, I am really going to have to, if I want to get anywhere as an artist, I'm just going to have to be an artist in the studio all the time and just let the chips roll where they may. And then things literally began to fall into place after that. I mean, it was very much a skin of the teeth kind of thing. But I just realized at some point, because I would do these, most of the work that I did in home improvements or building out galleries and all this kind of stuff was, they would be like 3-week jobs, 4-week jobs. And I would be completely committed, and then I would finish the job, and I'd have some pile of money to live off of, and I would be so sort of exhausted and out of the routine of working all the time on my work that I realized it was becoming counterproductive, even though money is such a necessary ingredient to sustaining a studio. I realized that it was being counterproductive for me to be able to get anywhere with my career, so I decided to do and to just really pull back from doing the contracting kind of work that I was doing, running the jobs I was doing. Simultaneously, people stopped calling me out of the blue. They just sort of ended, and the art stuff started to sort of fall into place. So it was really synergy. It all just... So I didn't, suddenly make a lot of money selling art and says, I can quit my day job now. I quit my day job before I knew that my dream job was actually going to be a legitimate reality, but I didn't think it would be a reality until I committed to it 100%, which I felt like I was committed to it 100% while I was working as a contractor and all that. But, after a while, you realize that you're just not doing it 100%. So, yeah. That was the transition.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. But Quit your day job. So it was really a leap of faith.
It was a leap of faith.
But I'm also guessing that you might have had some sense that, your work was going well and people were responding to it.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was like things where I was getting more and more busy. It's funny. I had a I'd have to say that things are kind of good for me now with, opportunities to exhibit my work and to exhibit new work and old work, and I'm pretty fluid with that. But I had my career really began, ironically, I live in New York and I'm from New York. My career began in Canada. That's where I had most of my first shows. We're all along in Toronto. I had a gallery and I showed all over. And then now most of my career is really taking place in Europe. And it's only now it seems like New York is starting to build up again, where I'm starting to have more and more opportunities in New York. So,
Do you think that, your work is so American.
Yeah.
So there must be something about it that has another layer in Europe. They have more distance and they can look at it.
Well, I said before about the imagery and the text, my work has really definitely been called, and I sense that it is this very American work on the surface. And then the text is really this sort of delusion disillusionment with America or with, like, getting fulfillment of this American dream and questioning whether this American dream really exists. And I do think that, so there's a little bit of a distance that I have from it being American, but it has a lot of the bells and whistles of pop, American pop art, American popular culture. So, yeah, it's very popular in a sense outside of America, where people are looking over the fence and trying to figure out what's going on in America. And, you know, like in Europe, like in France, for example, where I have had a lot of great opportunities, I mean, the French are really funny because they love America. They love American films. They love American music. Woody Allen, Jerry Lewis. But they don't love American people. They have a lot of love and hate for America. And so my work, in a way, it has these sort of nuggets of a love-hate relationship with America. And I think that it is easier. It is a very palatable kind of message for an outsider looking in at America. So,
yeah, I thought what you were going to say is, like, I think that the timing for your work here also is probably, it seems like that's what America is, what we are coming to here.
It's perfect because we're all disillusioned.
Yeah.
except for the very, very rich who are the ones that buy art. That's the only problem.
Well, it's also really
they're not disillusioned at all.
Save me an hors d'oeuvre. I want to go to Europe.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking is that, you know, it's kind of funny because, like, what's happening in America now is that, like, we're sort of all, like, saying this the American dream is bullshit. And even being an American doesn't mean what it used to, right? Because it used to be meaning, like...
Yeah, I mean, look at our country. We're fucked up right now. The politics are so fractured. And, yeah, the wealthy people are really, really getting more and more distant from the rest of the nation. And they're also steering the ship of where the nation's going and leaving behind, you know,
us.
Classes of people. Yeah.
And a lot, yeah, a lot of people, not just, well, like, we're,
yeah,
we're fucking... Freaking white.
Right.
I can't complain.
We shouldn't complain. No, but they're leaving behind.
A lot of people.
And so, you know.
Like what Donald Trump said, like, don't let the Syrians in. Like, yes, like, I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, you know, Donald Trump is somehow he talks about disillusionment in America, and even though he's grabbed half of it for himself, but he's just sending a potent message, but... You know, God help us if he becomes...
Even. Oh, that won't happen. That'll never happen. I mean, Hillary really made him look like, he's a joke.
No, he is a blowhard joke. And, you know, also, I mean, well, I mean, I can't say...
Yeah, don't say it on the radio, yeah. For God's sake.
No, but I mean, I think that the way his business practices were, his treatment of... his own employees, women employees. I mean, this, I can't say substantiate any of this, so I don't want to say it on the radio. But, I mean, there's a lot of holes. You know, the guy's filed for bankruptcy. He failed miserably and took down a lot of Atlantic City. You know, he has a lot of hubris and very little to back it up,
well,
except he's, you know, managed to parlay his father's millions into billions of his own. So
yeah, he's basically like, he's all full of hyperbole. I mean, you can't, he's just like he's a totally invented person in that way.
Yeah, and
he has no experience of what, like, actually, like, living on
in, but he's totally invented. But the thing that he's has not invented was that he really came from a very, very well-off father who he took over the business. A lot of kids take over their dad's business and they flush it down the toilet. He turned it into a gold mine. So, you know, but does that really...
But that's
not really the idea of coming from nothing, which is sort of the...
No, the first million, they say the first million is the hardest to make.
Right, he already had that. So.
And also, the guy was pretty fucking lucky on timing. If you own Manhattan real estate in, like... 1970, 80, 90, you'd be a billion, you know.
Yeah. If I bought any of the buildings that I looked at in the 90s, any of them, I'd be a millionaire right now.
Let me ask you this, David. Do you ever feel like just maybe a little competitive with Donald Trump?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Do you ever think like, you know, if my father had like gave me a studio or something like that? Do you ever think like that?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really do think that, like, you know, I do think that he did take all of this. He was set up to succeed, and I may have been set up to succeed, but you know, my father died when he was quite young, and so did my mother, for that matter. So, you know, I never really had all of those. You know, I had some advantages because they had some money, and I was left with a little bit of money, but you know, they. You know, whatever. That guy was like, he had a going concern that he just took over and ran with it. And that's great.
I have to say, this is Radio Free Brooklyn because it's that time. So I want everyone to know that you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, which is the best radio station in the Western Hemisphere. And this is Dr. Lisa Giving a Shit with David Kramer as my guest. There was something I am feeling like part of what is going on is that we are talking about the feeling of success.
Mm-hmm.
And as a creative person, because I was like, when we were talking,
we talk,
you don't think so.
No, I know. I mean, I don't, as you said, like, I actually said I was happy before, you know, like or whatever you had said, but the gist is that, I don't really sit here and ever think that I'm a success.
I'm feeling like I'm really, really stressed out. That's the problem I'm having, is mm-hmm. that I'm having, this is what's going on. I'm having this huge transference, and I'm having like, I've been having a meltdown for like 2 days about all the projects that don't make any money. Well, one of them makes some money, and I'm under like, I'm afraid I'm going to fucking fail.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so funny, like listening, like David, like right now I'm jealous of you.
That's nice.
But at the same time, I think about like about a couple of months ago, how horrible it was when you were. Remember how upset you were? I mean, I am, David. I'm telling you my feelings, but you know, at the end of the day, that I want you to do well, and that I am your cheerleader.
Yeah,
trust me with
that. Okay, sure.
Okay. So, but I'm just saying. Like, I remember. It's just hard to remember. You know, we just have to appreciate how far we've come sometimes.
Yeah, I know. I think what you're referring to is, and again, this, you know, you, from our friendship, you know that, like, you know, the thing that's so funny is, like, a couple of months ago, I was sitting around and I really had nothing on my calendar to speak of, and I was feeling pretty miserable, like, but, you know, as if everything that I had done for 5 or 6 years had just come to an end. And it had, literally, because I also, during that period of time, decided to, you know, really readdress a lot of things in my work and really push my work. So that's a very dark period of time to go through. And then here it is in this fall, I have, you know, I mean, I just told you about 4 or so shows that I'm in simultaneously. Yeah. So it is like, I'm sitting on a very different place than I was, but I'm still traumatized.
No. Aw. No, but see, I'm remembering back to that liquid lunch.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, like, I mean, I never lose faith in you. I really don't. But
well,
I remember identifying with you. I know how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
And where you're worried where your work is going, or if it's going anywhere, or if it's ever going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And you were in that place.
Yeah.
And I know how hard, that's normal. I think I told you that it was normal,
no,
right?
Yeah, sure.
And it is normal, but we all go through that. And I just remember how, like, man, you know, I know David's going to get out of this. I hope it happens sooner or later. So it's just really cool how full circle it is. And actually, for me, who I happen to be going through my own, the last couple of weeks, I've got like a bunch of projects. One makes no money, that's very important, and one that's not as much of a push forward, but still exciting, that would make money. So I've got these two at the same time that I'm trying to balance, and I don't have the most stable ego a lot, mm-hmm. and so I've been freaking out, which is probably what made me think of calling you first to come in today to help me.
Yeah. Well, hang in there. You're doing great. I think that generally speaking, like, you know, artists tend to have – I had a teacher in school who said that at graduate school at Pratt Institute here, and he said, if you're a good artist, you have like – if you're – a lot of people have like one really good run in them. And if you're a really good artist, and that run could be like 3 years or a year, 3 years, maybe 5 years. And if you're a really good artist, you'll have two really good runs in you that are those three, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 year runs. And if you're a great artist, well, then you'll just keep having these different runs. But which was a very strange thing to hear. But the thing that is interesting about that is I think that like, yeah, you go on a run, you have a lot of shows, and they lead to other shows, or they lead to other opportunities, and then all of a sudden, it just naturally comes to some kind of a halt for a while, and it takes a lot of inner strength to get that back up, and I think that you will do that. I have total faith in you.
Thanks, David.
I really do give a shit, really? Dr. Lisa. You're going to be fine. You have that inner strength, but it is hard not to kick yourself while you're down. At least for me.
Right now I'm in the phase of like, the worst phase is the phase where you're afraid you're never going to have another idea or a good idea or do another decent project. Right now I'm in the phase which has its own certain pain or anxiety. I'm in a very anxious phase where I have to get things done and I have things I want to do, and there's timing on them. So that's actually a little bit better than the phase of like, what the fuck is going to... I mean, it's right. Thinking like, what am I going to do next is more relaxing,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
But when you actually have things that, like when you're getting ready for you, it's. I mean, you're getting ready for a show, or you've been doing some films, and you're in production on a film. Is the film going to come out the way you want it to, right?
No, I mean, the hardest part is, I mean, personally... The hardest part is after a show is over, the beginning of the next phase. The beginning's the hard part, like you're talking about. But the part where you actually have deadlines and all is, like, some people don't like that. I love that. You know, I want deadlines. But I totally understand what you're saying. And when you have those deadlines and you really have to make the right decisions, it's really hard.
It depends also like on the deadlines. Like if I had to make like 50 text paintings in a month, I think I'd be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have to make, or like, you know, different sizes, like say 10 paintings, 5 different sizes each, that's mm-hmm. fine. But to like come up with like something I haven't done before.
Yeah, well, that's really hard.
You know, or like, is this new show going to work out?
Right.
You know, this new idea. I'm doing this new idea focus group
mm-hmm.
with like a funny focus group. Something like that. I've never done it. How's that going to go? You know what I mean? Because you don't know when you have no... Or when I started doing this radio station, I was really nervous.
Sure.
I'm still kind of nervous.
Yeah. Well, you don't seem nervous.
I don't? Oh, that's good.
You're very natural. No, but it's very funny. Like, I, you know, I don't know. Like, I decided after doing this, the last few shows, I've had some... I used to make a lot of films, and then I kind of stopped. And then this year... I made a film with a friend, and I ended up showing a film I made with him, and an old film that I'd made in France at the Pompidou, which was like totally thrilling.
So cool.
So then I was like totally inspired to make another film, and then these people in Nebraska asked me to show one of my older films. It's like 6 years old, and yeah, the response was just so great to this film that I hadn't really taken a look at in a long time. And now all of a sudden I'm like, I'm going to make another film. Like, this is like all I can think about. And I don't even know what form it's going to take. I just know I'm going to make one. And that is sort of like a really funny place to be, because you can talk about it and get yourself all jazzed up. And then all of a sudden it's like, I got to start working on this thing. Whatever this thing is, I have no idea, but I got to figure it out. And... that is the thrilling part. And that is, like, funny, like, even, like, sometimes, like, even Susan will say to me, you don't know anything about making a film. Why are you doing it? And then I would make a film, and she's like, you do know what you're doing. So,
I know. It's been, a few years ago, we've talked about this with you, is, like, you had that huge screening at Feigen, and mm-hmm. it was packed, and it had, like, three or four of your films, and it was your solo show there. They had a screening night, and, I mean, the crowd was totally enthused, and I think Walter Robinson showed up, right? You have, like, really high-end people there.
I've made a lot of, it's funny, but I never took a film class. I don't know anything about how to make. I don't even know how to edit. I just get people to help me, and I've traded drawings for people to make music for soundtracks. You just have to throw yourself into these kind of projects. And the thing I really don't understand more than anything are how some artists, you can see their work over a 10-year period, and the work doesn't change that much. My work kind of changes a lot because I'm just always trying to wrestle with something that I'm not so comfortable with. And anyway, I think it sounds to me like you're wrestling now yourself with something you're not completely comfortable with, but that doesn't mean you're not going to figure it out and make it work. So, hang in there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do what I can do. The thing I worry about is getting in my own way. The mm-hmm. thing I worry about is getting really insecure and anxious and then, like, throwing wrenches in there or not so much alienating people, but convincing people that they shouldn't have faith in me by accident.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not good PR.
I think I'm a master at it.
Make sure you don't, the person who's sponsoring the project, make sure they don't feel like you're letting them know that they hired the wrong person.
Exactly. And, I have gotten, when you work, like, doing that, like I did in advertising, people know you. You can't pretend that you're not anxious.
Yeah.
Like you can when you send a presentation out in an email. Like,
right.
It doesn't matter if I'm anxious. I know I'm anxious. Just get the thing out, make it fine, and then, like, I have to deal with it, and everyone I come in contact with has to deal with it. But the client will be okay.
I have had, really bombed studio visits where I've had, like, a dealer come in and say to me, well, looking at my work and scratching their head, what exactly does a show of yours look like? Because the work is sort of all over the place between paintings and drawings and sculptures and videos. And I looked back at this dealer and said, well, I really don't know. I don't know until.
You say that?
Yeah. So, and I did not do a show with that person. So you don't want to.
Do you regret saying that?
Well, it was, my.
I mean, like,
I was just being honest and not very cagey. I was being very direct. Yeah, well, that didn't work out. It's not like I haven't had other shows to replace that show.
Yeah, but would you not do that again?
I think.
I mean, there's part of me that goes, that's a good idea because that takes the pressure off of you. And why bullshit? And they like your work. They'll give you time.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But on the other hand, you want the show, so you've got to manage
it, right? Some people are very good at steamrolling their way into getting opportunities. And, I'm not really a good steamroller like that. I get opportunities because people, I just make work, I bury myself in it, and people like what I do, and and that's been the story.
That seems like the best. I love that. When I'm in that phase, mm-hmm. I'm super happy. When somebody actually gives me a green light, that's when I freak out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Does that happen to you?
Well, I mean...
No, because... You're also really good at making things.
Well, for example,
I worry that I don't have, that I don't, like, I can't stay up all night. I don't have that.
Yeah, anymore. No, I don't, I do that sometimes, but I have a meeting, I'm in France, I'm going to have a meeting with someone who wants to do a show in Belgium, so we have a discussion to discuss, and, he's going to ask me, all I really want from him is a date. Like, I don't want to tell him what I'm going to do or what it's going to be like.
Oh, really?
And, if he's waiting for me to pitch him a show, it's not going to be a very good pitch.
See, that's really good for me to hear, because if I was in that that situation, also, you know, being an art director, mm-hmm. a former art director, I would, like, my instinct is to have that put a pressure on myself, have every minutia of it worked out, costs, how right. it's going to get there.
You're much smarter, but I never come up with the elevator pitch. That's
but
the problem.
I don't know if that's helping me. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you go there and he knows your work, he knows what you're capable of, yeah. and then he agrees to it, he'll be happy and surprised when he gets what he gets, right?
Yeah, that's how, how I roll, you know, that's how I've rolled this far into my career.
And I think that takes more confidence.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, like, I think that I think that the guys who have the elevator pitch or have a lot of confidence, I just am not that strategic, you know, in that regard. I'm not that strategic. And that is something I perhaps wish I was, but... you know, it's just at this point in my life, it's not going to suddenly emerge. I've had a pretty. I mean, like you, you know,
it
I've,
works.
It's been working, and
it works for you.
Yeah, it works. So,
yeah.
And I follow these hunches. Like now, I feel like I got to make this film project, which I could give you my elevator pitch right now for what that project's going to be. But it's. But I'll tell you what it is. I'm going to make reenact. A lot of really embarrassing moments in my life.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
Building props, the whole thing, try to from memory, really embarrassing, like things I've said in conversation that I wish I could take back. I'm going to just reconstruct these things and film them.
That sounds really
my project. So that's my elevator pitch.
That sounds great. Why don't we have a Kickstarter for that? We'll pitch it on the radio.
I would like that, yeah.
Sounds exciting.
That's my next.
But that's a really cool idea.
That's my next. I'm just going to, like,
that
things
idea.
That have, like, stayed with me for really long periods of time. That I can't stop getting those stories out of my head that I really regret. I'm going to reenact them like as best as I can.
I think that's
with
fantastic.
Scripts and other people, and you know the whole. That's
the people that you actually went through the.
No. There'll be actors playing those other people's parts.
Oh, that's so great. That sounds like a great idea. So do you want to have a do you want to like have a should I tell you should we talk about what this conversation was about?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's your motivation?
do you want me to tell you what I think we talked about?
Yeah.
Or what I think happened here?
What has happened here?
Okay. So anyway, this was sort of something I've been thinking about that you reiterated today when you came in. Why don't I do a psychoanalysis of the whole thing? So anyway, so it's interesting experience. I think that you and I have some of the same issues. So we are seeing both sides of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm in a really vulnerable place right now. And you are in a, in a really great place. And I'm having a hard time being objective about it because I'm probably being a little intimidated by how great you're doing and how shitty I'm doing.
And you have a radio show. I don't. You're doing pretty good.
but I know. So that's my first instinct. That's my counter transference. Uh-huh. But I think that I'm getting a – like – I think that you're in a place right now where you can sort of reflect back on how you have gotten to where you are based on your instincts, and your instincts are good. And then when you look at your family is really stable and stuff like that. And there are things that are bothering you that aren't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But all things being equal, I think that you had a lot of growth in the past month or so, a lot of really positive growth, having the... come to fruition of the show in Germany and the show in Nebraska, and it's great. I'm getting some reflection of that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Sure. No, I mean, this has been like it's nice to be here talking with you because, you know, it's given me an opportunity to sort of talk out loud and reflect and even talk out loud and pitch my next project. You know, it's mm-hmm. very good. But my complaints about what's going on right now are practical matters of things.
Money.
But, money. But the reality is that, yeah, I mean, like, I've really, I feel like the kinds of responses that I've gotten to my work has just, like, been really, like, a little bit mind-blowing in a way to hear such positive feedback about things from the audiences that are seeing them. And that, you know, as an artist, you don't really tend to hear applause ever, because it's not like being an actor where the show ends and people stand up and start hooting and hollering. You don't get that.
Well,
but,
yeah.
You know, but I have gotten some of that from these shows, really. People have.
And the press.
In the press. That's and the even at the head. At the openings, people have sure. come up and really just, you know, really responded in a way that is just like, it's kind of mind-blowing. So, yeah, it makes me feel very confident right now and very – I have grown a lot, because it's like, wow, this is – it's effective. It's working. And like I said, 6 months ago, I was in a totally different place. You know that, because we have this friendship and, you know, but I also really readdressed my work in a really serious way, and it's just amazing that that's – starting to really show its fruit right now. So
yeah, and hearing about that film is really exciting. Like, you have something else on top of that. Like, it's not just like you have something to look forward, like you can get past that. But you know what I'm also thinking about? I'm thinking about our old dead friend Annie Herron.
Yeah.
One quote has always stuck with me. Annie Herron, for those of you who don't know, is was a great curator and gallerist who
yeah.
passed away at age 50 of cancer, but a very important part of the Williamsburg scene in the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, in the Lower East Side as well, in yeah. the 80s. She ran Semaphore Gallery.
Yeah, I didn't know her, you know, mm-hmm. in those days, but...
No, I knew her from Brooklyn.
You know her a lot longer
yeah,
than I did.
Yeah, from Brooklyn, from Williamsburg.
Yeah, but anyway, she always says, showing your work, and I say this to young artists, showing your work will change your work.
Uh-huh.
So I think there is...
She's right.
Yeah. And I think that that never ends.
No.
And I think, like, as visual artists, it's really hard, because when you, like, hang up your show, or they hang up your show, the gallery hangs up your show, whatever. Like, even when I went to Miami, that was the biggest show I ever had, I think, last year ago.
I saw that. That was great.
Thanks. But anyway, I mean, basically, the work got shipped there. I saw it hung up for a couple of hours, and then maybe went back here or there, but you're not, like, that's your work, and you're not there with it. You're not
no.
having any experience of it. You're not.
I mean, that's really been the funniest thing about my career, because most of the shows I've done, as I said, I mean, I've done a lot of shows in New York, but a lot of the work I've done has been out of town, and it's really funny to hang a show, go to the opening, and then basically the next morning get on a plane and leave and never see that work ever again.
Yeah, and if it gets sold, forget it.
Forget it, right.
And then you have the gallerists never tell you where it's going, right?
No. I mean, sometimes they give you a name, but, you know, that doesn't really mean that much.
Yeah, like, you don't know.
But it's a very strange thing, and I did, like I said, like, so by the responses that I was getting in from people while I was in town and these shows was just really, really heartwarming, and that was quite remarkable.
I'm so glad that I got you to come in today, because uh-huh. it's so inspiring. I'm, like, so energized by hearing about all this. I really am, in spite of my countertransference. And my neurosis. I mean, today is, like, the hardest day, all the deadlines that I have. And I don't need to fucking apologize, Lisa. Stop a fucking apologize for yourself. You're fucking great. Just shut the fuck up.
Here, here. You're doing great.
bleh. So we're going to have to wrap it up. And, so we learned a lot there. And I also wanted to point out, you know, these, you know, comedians and performers, and I do some of that myself. It's so different, because you are making contact with the audience the entire time. Your work is you are feeling the response of your work in the moment. I mean, maybe you forget about the next day and it's ethereal. You don't really have anything to show for it. Maybe a video that you don't want, that I hate watching. I never watch myself. But anyway, so it's interesting. You know, the whole creative thing is hard and fabulous.
Well, it's always nice, you know, to sit here and talk about your paintings and drawings to an audience that can't see them. So,
well, we're going to post them. When go to Radio Free Brooklyn, they're going to see them. And I posted your video on my Facebook page.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they can't see them.
Go to my Facebook page look at Kramer's video. It's really funny. It's the one he showed in Nebraska. Uh-huh. And you can find him on Google David Kramer.
Yeah.
With that's capital K-R-A-M-E-R. All right, so we're going to wrap it up here. I'm watching the clock count down.
Thank you, Lisa.
And